Hello and welcome to the MIT Press Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondak. And today I'm going to be speaking with Tom Seto about his new book, Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Tom Seto has been a professional animator since 1975. One of the key players in Disney's animation revival of the 1980s and 90s, he worked on such classic Disney films as The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and The Lion King. He left Disney to help set up the DreamWorks Animation Unit in 1995. He's professor of cinema practice in the School of Cinematic Arts at the University of Southern California. Tom Seto, thanks for taking time to speak with the MIT Press Podcast today.
Hi, great to be here.
So now in this history of computer animation, you go back to some men who were active in animation before the advent of computers. Some, like Walt Disney, are famous. But one man stuck out to me, Oscar Fissinger. Could you explain who he was and why you included him in your book?
Yes, I can. We have a tradition in animation and film. There's an earlier pioneer named Edward Muybridge. And Muybridge did some of the earliest motion experiments using photography that greatly influenced the birth of motion pictures, both live action and animated film. But the interesting thing is that Muybridge himself never touched a movie camera. And didn't actually make or direct film or animation himself. He still had this influence. And I believe Oscar Fissinger had the same kind of influence on computer graphics. Fissinger was a German expressionist, which was an artist and filmmaker, who was very active in the 1930s and had to flee Hitler. And he settled in California. And his artwork basically was of a very abstract nature. It was about moving shapes to music. In effect, what he was talking about was visual music. And he was very interested in the mechanical means of creating imagery that coincided with music. And his work influenced the first generation of experimental filmmakers who were working with World War II surplus equipment, oscilloscopes, radar scopes, trying to tame those light beams into making images. And it's really sort of the precursor, sort of the analog precursor of computers. Fissinger's work was very influential to a lot of these people, even though Fissinger himself, never pushed a mouse.
Do we know who the first person was to make a computer create visual images? And were those images static or could they be animated?
Well, the first images were static. What they were doing in the late 40s and early 1950s was, again, they were trying to figure out a way to create shapes using the light waves of an oscilloscope or a radar scope, and they found that if you created a particular type of shape and you froze it, they actually would point the camera at the radar scope and take a picture of the screen. And then they would advance the image, and then take another picture, and take a series of pictures like that. As early as 1954, there was a man in Utah named Ben Lapolsky, and he was creating these very early images using the oscilloscope. It wasn't until about the late 50s. That they started to realize that there's just, it's a little too limiting to try to do something directly with an oscilloscope beam, and people started to learn about the new system of pixels.
You mentioned Utah in that answer. I have no background in the history of computer animation, and I was surprised to learn just how much of computer animation was developed in Utah, particularly through the company of Evans and Sutherland. Could you talk a bit about this?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty fascinating. Ivan Sutherland, of course, did his graduate work at MIT, and at MIT he basically wrote the first animation software 50 years ago exactly. This program called Sketchpad, and then he later was working in Harvard, working in experimental electronics and virtual reality. He made friends through a government program. With this guy named David Evans, and Evans was from Utah. He was of the Mormon Church, but he was working at Stanford, and roundabout the early '60s, the president of University of Utah convinced Evans to come home and try to establish some kind of program at Salt Lake, at that university. Of course, you know, that university is distinct from Brigham Young University. They're separate entities, although they did share faculty. Evans, due to his friendship with Sutherland, had wanted to go into some kind of partnership, not only as instructors, but also to do some things in the private sector. And at one point they considered, you know, doing it in Massachusetts because of, you know, Sutherland was at Harvard. But then basically it was decided by their wives because because Mrs. Evans said, you know, we have 7 children and we have to pull them all out of school and stuff. And Ivan and his wife only have 2 kids. And so it's a lot less ripping up of roots, you know, for them to move west than for us to move east. So they decided to settle in Utah. And when they began the program, you know, Evans said, you know, the opening field of experimentation with computers is so vast. How do you think we should approach this? Because we're a small school, we can't possibly do it all. And Sutherland said, let's just pick one thing and focus on it. And the thing that they picked was graphics. They said, we want to figure out a way to make graphics work, and through computers. Interestingly enough, talking to some of their pupils in the program they established, they said in that early period, which is like about the late 1960s, not only did they have to, argue for the validity of their program against skeptics in the private sector, they also even have to argue with fellow professors, because some of the professors from chemistry and biology and, you know, physics and some of the other ones would say, you know, why are you wasting valuable grant money on making pictures? Like, isn't there something more relevant you could be doing, you know?
Let's talk about another man who appears in your book, Alvy Ray Smith. Why is he important to the history of computer animation?
Okay. Yeah. Alvy's a great guy. He's originally from Texas, and a brilliant man, and a wonderful character. He originally was he had tenure at NYU while still a young man, in a very advanced form of quantum mathematics. In fact, he joked around that only a few people in the science community could even talk to him and knew, you know, what the program was he was doing. The nature of it and all was so unique that it was difficult to explain. But he had this hunger to want to do art. So he was a case of someone who was a scientist, but also was very interested in exploring his creative side. And this was like sort of the late 60s, early 70s, and it was the hippie period. And Alvy, like, just at one point, just, you know, he had a skiing accident. And while he was holed up in the hospital, you know, wrapped in a body cast, he was sort of reevaluating his life. And finally he just decided, you know, I got to go to California. I can't take it anymore. And he just dropped his tenureship and resigned and just, you know, drove out to California and was living in Palo Alto with a friend on his, sleeping on his floor. But his friend was one of the leaders of the research group, called Xerox PARC, which was doing some of the first breakthroughs in GUIs, you know, graphic user interface, and some of the first breakthroughs in personal computing, but also in imagery. And Alvy is one of the seminal people in the development of surfacing, and basically creating solid shapes with computer graphics. Up to this point, computer graphics had mostly been these wireframe images. You know, they look like glowing erector sets. You know, they call them vector images. And Alvy and his team had spent a lot of time working on putting skin and surfacing on these images so they could be lit and real objects, and also cast shadows and have highlights on them so they could be indistinguishable with solid, real-time objects. The other thing Alvy did a lot of development on was the alpha channeling, and alpha channeling is basically a way to for the computer to discern solid objects and the hierarchy of where they are in a shape. So, you know, if you have a hand touching a table, if the hand doesn't go through the table, that, you know, the computer understands that the table is a solid object. So the hand stops, you know, on the surface of the table. Alvey started this kind of work at Xerox PARC, and then followed it through to the New York Institute of Technology, where he ran back across the country, and then was working out in Long Island. And then when Lucasfilm began, he went once again back across the continent to California, and the Lucasfilm Graphic Group, of which he was like one of the main people, and later became the technical end of Pixar Studios.
You mentioned LucasArts, and for a lot of people, Star Wars was a seminal moment in rethinking what could be shown on screen, and LucasArts was a big player in computer animation, which is ironic because that first Star Wars film actually had very little computer animation in it.
Yeah, it was an eye-opener as I was doing the research that a lot of these like very important science fiction movies that we're so inspired by and seem so futuristic and far out, like 2001: A Space Odyssey and the first Star Wars movie, had very little actual computer animation in them. It was mostly done in the old-fashioned techniques that a filmmaker of the 1940s and 50s would understand, the same kind of special effects that was done back then. But stuff was made to look like computers. And in fact, here's a fun little trivia bit. What was the first movie that when you turn on a computer and you see an image, it's actually that real computer and it's not optically added afterwards in post effects?
What is it?
Jurassic Park. It's like all the way up to that point, whenever any movie, when you see computer screens, the light resolution was so weak on the monitors that they wouldn't appear on movie film. All you would see are like black bars, you know, like they wouldn't read. So what they had to do was that they had to optically put those in the post-production process. And Jurassic is the first time that when Samuel Jackson turns on his computer, you're actually seeing what he's seeing on the computer.
The actor Andy Serkis has made quite a name for himself in Hollywood in roles that have made use of some pretty heavy technology, roles like Gollum in Lord of the Rings or as Caesar in Planet of the Apes. But as you point out, there's some controversy about how much he is acting versus how much is the skill of the animator. Could you explain?
Yes, yeah. It is very controversial in the film world, and one of the things that I try to do is that a lot of the existing literature about the technique that he uses is this technique called motion capture, where you take an actor and you cover them with sensors, and then everything the actor does, becomes data for the computer. So the computer, recreates his movements exactly, and It's a technique that actually does go back, the beginning of film, about 100 years. They used to call it rotoscope, where they would take an actor and they would film him, and then they would trace over with paper, what the actor was doing. Even famous movies like Snow White and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and Captain Hook, they would use a little bit of that live action reference. It was still the animator's art, but they would use the live action as sort of a basis to go off of. But this computerized technique of motion capture is touted by its adherents as being this new art form, and it's not animation, and it's like it's better than animation. And speaking as someone who is a traditional animation artist. The people in our community always found this like a little off-putting, which is, if you're going to bring up this new technology, that's great, but don't talk smack on us. We're not going after you. Why do you feel like you need to tout the virtues of your program by running down, what we do? Being one of these kind of artists, I can kind of describe the other side of this argument, which is that in many of these more famous characters, they still need traditional animators or traditional animation artists working on the computer to work with the images and push them, and basically we call it like massaging the images to create the performance that everybody recognizes. For instance, one of the things that they're still having a lot of trouble doing with is eyes. You know, no matter how many sensors and how much of this great sensitive stuff they have about, oh, we can do this, we can do that. In most of these movies, even Gollum and Lord of the Rings, a lot of times the eyes are still being keyframed because the sensitivity of the sensors and all isn't good enough yet to catch that. It might happen one day, but I think there's a certain amount of a selling job on both sides of how important their contribution to the process is as to what it might actually be. But it makes for a pretty lively debate.
So where are we in computer animation today? In the next few years, are we just going to be improving on current systems, or is there a new game changer out there that the public may be seeing in the next few years?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the integration of the digital images and human beings is going to become more and more common. I mean, we're now used to the fact of you see a movie like The Avengers or any of these sort of high tech superhero films, and a lot of times there's a digitized character filling in for the human actors. I mean, Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus fighting on top of a moving subway train, most of that was animation. it looked like live action. Yeah. Plus, you're going to see these movies. In the industry, we call these hybrids of a live action film with one animated character, like the movie Ted, or Garfield, which is a live action film, and then there's one character that's animated. I think they're going to become more subtle and more human-like. Now, in terms of really advanced technology, there's people working with behavioral software, where you can basically put personality characteristics, into the characters. They could do that now with the little warriors in the program called Massive, where you have 10,000 orcs and 10,000, soldiers, and they all fight one another, independently. That I think will become more sophisticated. And one of the other discussions I've heard around is people saying, in 100 years, one of the only things that hasn't changed is the movie screen. It's still the same movie screen that we've been looking at. So maybe that's the next thing to be challenged. Can films really come out into the crowd? How far do we want to go with 3D? And of course, to try to figure out a way to get rid of the big ugly goggles that nobody likes.
Tom Cito, the author of Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Thanks for being on the MIT Press podcast today.
Thank you. I had a great time.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at mitpress.mit.edu. Don't forget you can find the MIT Press on Facebook, www.facebook.com/MIT Press. And you can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at MIT Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the MIT Press podcast. Copyright 2013, the MIT Press. All rights reserved.